All right, welcome to class today. I hope you all had yourselves a restful and beneficial weekend. To begin with, I wanted to look at the quiz that was due over the weekend. So we were doing pretty well on this. There was a miskeying which got corrected about 30 minutes ago, so if you checked your grade before that, you may have seen a slightly different answer. Anyway, we'll just go over it. In knowing how to count subsets, the vast majority of you got this right. I will just comment the most popular incorrect answer here was this idea of the 21 factorial in the bottom. Remember, we need the 10 because we don't care about the order of things in the 10 in the part that is not included, just as we don't care about them in the part that is included. With the coins in the pocket questions, we were not doing as well. These were the questions that we spent some time with last time, counting donuts and numbers that summed things and so forth, right? And so as a reminder here, when we have 20 coins divided between three places, we can imagine a sequence containing all of the coins and two breaks between locations. And so if we imagine such a situation, then there are going to be 22 distinct elements, and we need to choose the place of the two breaks between elements in that. So we end up with 22 choose two for that model. And we spent some time on this last week as well. If instead we say there's going to be at least one, we can think of simply a list of a sequence of all the possible places a break could be between the coins. So imagine the 19 places that could land between coins. We need to check two of those. And so we have 19 choose two as the ways of dividing them up. Questions about these questions here? You're still welcome to ask them, but I'll move on while I'm waiting for Nate to appear in the chat. All right, this one I think we deserve a little bit of discussion. Three quarters of you got it right, but let's just sort of talk about why. And as I briefly glanced at it, I wasn't necessarily convinced that everybody got it right for the right reason. So the first number, I guess, has 1 in 100 chance of being correct. Okay. The second number, I guess, will I even get to a second number? I will get to a second number in 99 out of 100 cases. And I have 1 out of 99 numbers left to guess because we cannot guess the same number twice in a row, which gives us 1 out of 100. Okay, so although I am slightly more likely for the second guess to be correct, I am also less likely to ever get to the second guess. And so the end result is that I also have this 1 in 100 option. So we have this is our answer here for number 6. I gave half credit for the 99 over 10,000, which would be what you would get if you assumed that you did repeat guesses. So if you change that 99 to 100 and forgot about the not guessing twice in a row, that is where you would end up. And then we have the one that people had much more trouble about. Okay, we had the 4 password rules. Let's go through sort of how these work. So I have written here a little Python program to deal with the probabilities of each. So let's consider first this first one. If I have a random string of 8 letters and digits, capital and lowercase. So then I have digits, lowercase letters, capital letters, 8 of them. Okay. And we'll see what these numbers are here in a moment, but that's how I figure this out. You might have wondered, what if I'm not allowed to include repetitions? I believe including or not including repetitions in anything that didn't specify won't change the answer of the relative ordering. But if it was, it would be that that 62 choose 10 instead of, sorry, choose 8 instead of to the 8th power. If I pick 4 random words for a 1,000-word list, that's simply 1,000 to the 4th. Or if you think they need to be different words, again, that could be 1,000 choose 4, but again, that won't change the relative ordering for this question. A random 8-word quote. Okay, now here there was some This is a fairly popular answer, and I have a postulate as to why. I have a postulate people thought we meant pick 8 random words from the 4 million words. That is not what quoting is, right? So if I were to say, for example, I do not like cake, you are not allowed to quote that as I like cake. Yes, that is a 3 words taken from what I said, but it is not a legal quote of what I said. Quotes need to be contiguous. So I gave half credit because if you thought instead they did not need to be contiguous and thought that there were 4 million distinct words in the language, then that would become the right answer. But that's not how quotes generally work. And then my last one is I pick 2 random 5-letter words from a list of 10,000 words. So 10,000 squared. And stick them together. Oop. And then randomly replace half of the letters with their symbol counterparts. Okay, so that is going to be, I need to choose 5 out of the 10 letters. So this is 10 choose 5, which I have written out there. And there is just being replaced by the symbol counterparts. So once I pick them, I just do the replacement. And so these are my 4 numbers. So if I, if I print them all out, we will see that A is larger than any of the others by a factor of more than 100. Why isn't it 10,000 choose 2? Because I'm replacing half of the letters. So I need to choose 5 out of the 10 letters to be replaced. Oh, why isn't it so? Right, so all of these ones that I have to the powers, if I don't tell you if you're allowed to include replacement duplicates, you could replace them with a choose instead, right? So this could have been, you could have interpreted it not allowing replacements in all of these cases, and so that would become 10 plus 26 plus 26 choose 8, that would become 1,000 choose 4, that would become 10,000 choose 2. Those won't change the relative orderings of the answers for any of these, because the total change there is less than this 200 factor that makes them all bigger than each other, particularly if you choose them consistently. I suppose if you thought some could have repetitions and some couldn't, even when they all said just random, then you could potentially invert the ordering. So you could have gotten the same ordering if you had interpreted no repetition as well. Other questions? All right, let me just say another word about why I asked this question. You have probably all had various times where people have told you how to pick good passwords. And commonly they will say, you should pick some random words. And that is a good thing to do if you pick enough words and they're actually random. Right? So if you pick something that could have appeared in speech, that dramatically reduces the search space, right? So 4 random words is almost the square of 8 word quote. And so when you have various advice about picking passwords, it's important to think about what is the rule you use to pick your password and how many of those are there. And part of the reason people suggest particular things is because numbers up to, say, this big can be brute forced by people that have the energy and time, right? Running a program to try out several billion passwords is actually a plausible thing to do. Exactly how we do that efficiently involves various techniques that you can learn about if you take a security course. But I didn't want you to sort of get this idea that saying that this is 4 words and that's 8 words does not therefore tell me that there are more possible ways of getting this than that, because I also need to know the process used to choose them. And that was the quiz. Thoughts, comments, questions about the quiz? Okay. I also need to apologize. I didn't realize until just, I don't know, 10 minutes ago that I had not posted the reading for today and tomorrow. I don't know how many of you are actually doing the readings before class. My experience has shown that at the beginning of the semester, many people believe they will be diligent and do the readings in advance, and that changes over time. But I've posted it now, and so we will sort of dive into this understanding a little bit. This comes in the section of the Mathematics for Computer Science book that talks about the basic data types or basic types that we deal with in the math of computing. Such things as sets and sequences that we have already talked about. And functions show up as another one of those types. And so we're going to talk some about functions. Let me do this. And to do that, we're going to start by contrasting function with something that you thought was a function but wasn't from computing. So we have the idea of a function, and we have the idea of a subroutine. There's different names for subroutine, and but this is a fairly common term, okay? A function is a concept from math. A subroutine is a concept from programming. And there are several specific differences about this, okay? If I say y equals f of x, where f is a function, I have told you everything you need to know, okay? There is no hidden information. If x is the same, then y will always be the same and nothing else is occurring. If on the other hand, in my programming, I were to say y equals foo of x, there's more stuff that could happen. So in addition to acting like a function and giving me an answer, I also might have side effects. Side effects are like return types that we don't have written out. So for example, one class of side effects I might think of is, do things get printed? Is there a log of what's going on? Have things changed on the screen? None of those are going to show up in Y in my code, but they're still caused by the function. So as causes that are not its, can have kind of effects that are not its return value, we generally call those side effects. And we also have the idea of state. And these are sort of like arguments that are not represented in what's going on. So, for example, I can relatively easily write a subroutine that returns a different value every time it is invoked, regardless of its argument. That is not functional, right? If I say that f is a function, then if you tell me x and the definition of the function, I can tell you y, and it's always going to be the same. Whereas a subroutine, that might change over time, because we can, in principle, access the entire state of the program, the value of every variable, every file on the hard disk, the time of day, everything about the world the computer can figure out could all be consulted inside my subroutine. And so when we talk about functions or methods or routines or subroutines or whatever we're calling them inside of programs, we're usually talking more than just functions. We're allowed to talk about more than just functions. And when I see a function invoked in my program, I don't immediately know if it's acting like a function or if it's acting like this more general sense of a subroutine. Analyzing subroutines will be an important part of sort of the theory of computing and analyzing what's going on. We're not going to dive much into that today besides just sort of pointing at sort of the way we can transform these into a model of functions. I can imagine there is this special argument that is the state of the world. And one of the return values is a new state of the world, where the state of the world, again, is all of the information that the subroutine is able to view. The contents of all memory, the behavior of all devices, the time of day, what's on all the hard drive, all of those kinds of things could be part of this state of the world. And so we can imagine subroutines as being this sort of much more complicated kind of multi-argument, multi-return value function that has a complicated kinds of values. This is going to turn out to be a little too complicated to do in practice. There's going to be various limitations of this and so forth that will mostly be alluded to rather than explicitly discussed in later courses, although some of our later courses, like computational theory, depending on exactly what version of it you have, may formalize this a lot more than others. But we're going to begin our analysis with this simple world, and we're going to start here because saying "and anything else could matter too" makes it really hard to analyze things. We're going to begin by analyzing things where we already know the set of values that could matter, and try to discuss what we might know about them. So functions are going to be our first area of discussion. All right. First, let's talk about how we represent a function. So how do we represent a function? We can represent them by a formula. And this is probably the way you have seen the most, right? So I could say, for example, that f of x is equal to x squared plus 3. This is a formula or equation for my function, and is a common way of dealing with things when they are readily represented in this way. I could extend that and think about representing them as code. As long as my code doesn't access anything other than its arguments, this can still work. So I could, for example, imagine defining f of x as, and then I could have multiple steps. So I could say y equals x times x, and then I could say z equals y plus 3, and then return z. Okay? And this is a sequence of steps that occur in some sort of order, in some sort of explained language. And the intent is for these to represent the same things, although because of the limitations of data type and so forth, they aren't always a perfect match. However, there are extra things I can do in code that are difficult to do in formulas, like writing loops and so forth. And so code has more expressive power than formulas. And is sometimes used because of that characteristic. The key concept of code for it to be a function is that the answer cannot depend on anything that wasn't initially given either by a constant, unchanging constant, or one of the argument variables. If it depends on anything else, then it's no longer a function because it has this sort of side effect or state expectation. So we represent by formulas and we represent by code. And you've already had classes in your life that have discussed functions in both of these ways, right? Your math classes have talked about this formula. Your programming classes have talked about doing it in code. There's two other ways actually we're going to sort of talk about representing them. We can write them as a set of sequences. And we can also represent them as a graph. Okay, so we'll talk about these a little bit. Question here. Yes, there's a question about what I mean by not accessing anything other than parameters. I mean, yeah, so the question is it global variables? Also memory and registers and so forth. So yes, anything that isn't the argument, absolutely anything else besides a constant and the argument cannot be accessed if we're a function. So if our code depends on global variables, not a function. If our code depends on the contents of memory somewhere, and that memory wasn't the argument, then also not a function. If our code depends on us checking the clock or the current temperature of the CPU or anything like that, also not a function. The classic example of a non-functional subroutine that we often use is a random number generator, or the time of day function. Right. Both of these are designed intentionally to behave outside of the domain of function. You can call the same subroutine repeatedly and get different answers. But in principle, if I go outside of the arguments in any way, then I am no longer included. When my argument is a pointer out to memory somewhere, then typically we assume that is included, although exactly how that works can change a little bit depending on who's doing the definition. Why couldn't I just call it a multi-parameter function? I absolutely can, right? So we talked about this idea that I can always transform a subroutine into a function with a sufficiently broad definition of the world. And so if I can identify all of the things that we can access outside of our parameters and enumerate them and turn them into that function, then I have a functional representation of my subroutine. However, the code itself will look like a function, and it isn't the function that we're really doing if we're accessing global variables. So we absolutely can try to scoop in all of that extra material we think about and put it as extra parameters of the function. But that makes our subroutine and our function have different arguments. All right. Let's talk about these other ideas, the set of sequences and the graph. So let's start with the set of sequences, and let's do this same function as a set of sequences. The general idea here is that I'm just going to make a pair argument result. So I can just try to enumerate all of the values of my function. So I could say, if you give me a 0, I'm going to give you back 3. And if you give me 1, I'm going to give you back 4. And if you give me 2, I'm going to give you back 7. And if you give me 3, I'm going to give you back, what is that going to be? 9 plus 3 is 12. And if you give me 4, I'm going to give you back 19. And so on. So we can simply enumerate all of the argument result sequences that could exist for all of the inputs in my function. Now, clearly this is difficult to actually provide this full enumeration unless the set of possible inputs is finite. If it's an infinite thing, then I'm going to have to resort to some other technique to describe that infinite sequence. But we can imagine this set of sequences, okay? And often we will represent this instead of in this big set notation, we will commonly draw this set of sequences as a table. We'll just essentially draw each of those sequences one per row. So we'll say when x is 3, 0, y is 3. When x is 1, y is 4. When x is 2, y is 7. When x is 3, y is 12, and so forth. This is just a different representation of that same idea of the set of sequences, different way of drawing it, and represents the same function that I have with my formula and my code. And this is going to be nice because it's going to give us access to the tools we have about sets and about sequences that we've already discussed. It's going to allow us to work off of some of those earlier tools we had available to try to understand how things work. The fourth way is a graph. And by graph, I don't mean a Cartesian plot that you learned about in your algebra classes. I mean instead the special thing that computer scientists call graphs. We'll talk extensively about graphs in CS 2150 and some of our other courses will discuss them as well. And so I'm not going to go a huge amount into this concept. But when we talk about a graph, let me just sort of say we have the idea of nodes and edges, sometimes also called vertexes. And there actually is a difference between node and vertex that we're not going to get into. And so the idea here is we will sort of draw, if I have this sort of node that's the number 0, that is going to map over to the node that is the number 3. And if I have the node that is the number 1, that is going to map over to the node that is the number 4. And the node that is the number 2 is going to go over to the node that is the number 7. And the node that is number 3, oh, we already had that, that is going to go over to the node that is the number 12, okay? So take each of these values that could be in or out of our function, and we draw an arrow between them if the function turns one into the other. And so this graph data structure is something you'll get to see more in later courses. We're not going to spend very much time on it in this class. I'll try using it occasionally to describe some properties of functions we're going to talk about, but they're not going to be the only way we're going to deal with them. But all four of these representations, formula, code, a set of sequences, or a graph can all represent the same function as we're going along. So before we move on to discuss important properties of functions, questions about any of these representations? All right. Oh, wrong button. Let's talk about some function terminology. Okay, so when I write something like f of x, y equals f of x, let's stick with this form. The set of allowable x is called the domain of f. So this is just some terminology. We call the set that the argument or parameters belong to the domain of our function. And it's worth noting that this domain might be a little bit complicated. So let's consider, for example, a function that has two arguments, right? So let's suppose I have f of x, y is going to be equal to x squared minus y squared, just to pick an arbitrary formula definition of a function. The domain of this is pairs of numbers. So generally, I might assume that this expects me to have real numbers. And so I want to be the set of pairs of real numbers. And the way I get a set of pairs is with my Cartesian product. Remember that the Cartesian product of two sets is the set of sequences made of those where the first element is from the first set and the second element is from the second set. And so this is going to be the domain of this function, assuming I think this is defined for real numbers as opposed to limiting it to natural numbers or the like. Okay, and so for multi-argument functions, I'm typically going to have a Cartesian product of the sets of each of the arguments as the domain of the function as a whole. Set of allowable y is called the codomain of f. Okay, what are the kinds of values that could be returned by our function? That is going to be the codomain. And so for this same f that we just did here, this f takes two real numbers and returns a number. And so the range in this function is going to be real numbers. And it is less common to have a Cartesian product in our range. It does happen. But if it happens, we had to sort of, particularly for formula-based functions, we had to write that out. So in your algebra classes, you probably only dealt with single-valued functions, that is to say, functions whose range was a number, as opposed to whose range was a pair or triple of numbers. However, this idea of having these larger ranges is certainly allowable. And so a lot of programming functions that we're trying to implement using code might have this idea of returning multiple values and therefore a Cartesian product codomain. There is also a distinct but related idea. The set of possible y is the range of f. What do I mean by the difference between the set of allowable versus the set of possible? Let me see if I can give an example. Let's suppose I define a function f of x is x squared, and I define, I just I'm going to say my domain is the natural numbers. So I'm limiting my definition of my function to only apply in the case where the domain is the natural numbers. It is common to say the range is also the natural numbers. Because if you square a natural number, you'll get another natural number. But I can't get, sorry, not the range, the codomain. The codomain is also the natural numbers. But I can't actually reach all of those natural numbers. In particular, if I think about the set that can be reached, and if I try to enumerate this, I've got 0 and 1 and 4 and 9 and 16 and so forth. And so this is going to be the range, the set of values I can actually reach for some x in the domain. And it, in general, is going to be, so the range is going to be a subset or equal to the codomain. This distinction between range and codomain matters a lot in some contexts and not very much in others. And so sometimes people use the word range when they really mean codomain, and other times they'll use the word range explicitly to mean this more limited sense. And so you'll sometimes need to know by context. In this class, I will do my best to always use the correct term. And so codomain is this sort of broader set that I design things to work across. This matters quite a bit when we think about programming languages. So the question, yes, and then we have this question, how does it mean to be allowed when some can never be reached? Let's just consider, for example, if I were to say, assuming you know it, Java or C, I'll talk about what this looks like in Python here in just a moment. But if I were to say something like int x equals y times y, where y was defined earlier as an integer. This multiplication function, it's not written in functional notation, but it's still a function. It has no side effects. It has no hidden state, doesn't rely on the state of the world in any way, and therefore it is a function. And it is common to say, I can get back an int. That's the type I'm going to give. Or if you prefer Python, we might say that the type of x times x is going to give me an int as the data type. Okay, whether that's defined in our variable or not is dependent upon sort of how you're, whether you're writing in Java or Python. But we're still having this idea that there is this broad sense of major data types represented in programming languages as the sets that are the domains and ranges of things. And yet some of those ints can never be reached. Like for example, 3 will never be the integer returned. Even though it is in what we're allowing in our programming language, it's not what will ever actually be possible. And so this notion will be common, where we're going to sort of make claims about the sets without actually knowing all of the reachable members. So we'll have these sort of supersets, these codomains that we're trying to discuss. We could also think, for example, about functions that we haven't yet evaluated for everything, or very expensive functions. So I have a function, for example, that takes a person and returns their name. In principle, the name that is returned could be any string. In practice, I very much doubt that most strings will appear in the range, but the codomain, in principle, includes all strings, or perhaps all non-empty strings, or something like that. And so we have a lot of these sort of harder to compute functions, either in the real world or in sort of mathematical situations where we haven't yet found out what all of the computable values are. And so the range is often unknowable, but this superset codomain often can be known. And if I can make claims about every element of the codomain, then I have by definition included the whole range. Okay. So we have this notion of domain, codomain, and range. There's two other terms that are sort of related to this that are worth noting. If I say that F is total, That means it is defined over its whole domain. So just as I can have elements in the codomain that can never be reached in the range, I also can define a function who I tell you its domain is larger than my definition will actually support. So for example, if I consider f of x is 1 over x, I might say the domain is the real numbers, but it is not total because of 0, for which this formula doesn't give me an answer. So if a function is not defined over the whole range, we call it partial. Defined over the whole domain, rather. Okay, so and again, this is fairly common in our programming experience to write functions that we say can accept an integer or a string or the like. They give this broad category of domain, but for certain specific elements, it fails to compute, either fails to compute the right value or fails to compute anything at all, stopping with an error. And so, it is common in practice for our subroutines to be implementations of partial functions, occasionally total functions, but often partial functions in practice. I should comment, there are multiple schools of thought in defining domain. Some schools of thought will define domain such that all functions are by definition total, and that is not the school of mathematical thought that is commonly used in analyzing programming. So we're going to allow both domain and codomain to be larger sets than the function actually is defined over. And then we're going to use this idea of range to talk about that restricted set that can actually result and discuss the functions either being total or partial to discuss whether it works for everything in its domain or not. With this, we can start to ask a question saying, does foo crash is related to saying, is the function computed by foo total? Okay. And so if I can represent what some code does as a function, and then verify that it is total, verify that all elements of the domain are included, then I can rule out crashing as a behavior that the function can create. Okay? And so having this mathematical definition of total versus partial allows me to get a mathematical definition of a class of errors I want to avoid. And so we'll see several others of those as the lecture progresses. But a lot of these tools are designed to allow us to mathematically ask this question. The reason we want to ask it mathematically is because we want to be able to prove things. We would love to be able to end up with a proof that my function never crashes. And to do that, I'm going to need to translate that into some math and run them at mathematical proof to make that claim. All right, so we have this terminology: domain, codomain, range, total, and partial. And total and partial, we could argue, are actually the beginnings of properties of functions. All right, so we have total and we have partial already. Okay, so total means all elements of domain work. What do we mean by work? If we think about the set of pairs model, I mean, there exists a pair
such that the first element of that pair is going. Let me write this out more fully. Okay, let me do this formally. I was going to do it in general forms first, but let's not. Okay, let's suppose that I say for all x in the domain, there's going to exist an a, b in the pairs such that a equals x. Pick any element of the domain you want, there is a defined pair for it. Okay, if we think about it in the graph, we think about this graph from value to value, we mean that all elements of the domain are on the left side of an arrow if it's total. And partial means not total. So these are two ideas we have. We have three more that are commonly used to discuss functions. And the remaining three have multiple names. There's two main naming schemes. And so we're going to discuss both naming schemes because they're both going to show up. How would I define two domains for A and B? Would you have to define two domains for A and B? No, by A and B here, I mean A is an element, is in the domain. Go away, zoom. All right, I mean that this is in the domain and this is in the codomain, right? Remember our pairs representation is an element from the domain and an element from the codomain paired up. And I guess for the sake of drawing partial, it is commonly done to sort of draw out something like this, where we would have various values in the domain and in the codomain. And this would show us that there is some value over here that doesn't point to anything if we're partial. Okay, so two conflicting terminologies. For the remaining three principles we're going to discuss. Something either called one-to-one or injective. We have something either called onto or surjective. And something either called a correspondence or bijective. And I guess there's actually a third terminology here, also called invertible. Oh, that's sort of used in both. Okay, we have these three principles we're going to try to talk about. One-to-one or injective. What do we mean by saying a function is one-to-one or injective? We mean, at most, one element of the domain maps to each element of the codomain. I never have two things mapping to the same value. Another way of putting this is saying that for all x element of the domain, y element of the range of the codomain, rather, it is the case that x not equal to y implies f of x is not equal to f of y. Give me different inputs, I will give you different outputs. I will never generate the same output for two different inputs. Okay? And so this is called one-to-one, meaning that for one element in the codomain, there is only one thing that maps to it. So there is one thing that maps to any one thing. This is called injective as opposed to surjective, sort of is a similar kind of idea, but comes from the more Latin-based and sort of means that I only have one. It has the same general idea. In modern parlance, it's more common to use the injective surjective language as opposed to the one-to-one and onto language, but both again are sometimes used. What is the relation? So it's deterministic. What is deterministic? All functions are deterministic, right? They don't depend on any external state, any random chance. What I'm saying by saying injective is not that it's deterministic, but that there's only one possible way of getting someplace. It's going to be part of the idea of invertibility, sort of turning it, the inverse into a function, as we'll talk about in a moment. Well, actually, we may talk about it on Wednesday. We will see. But all functions are deterministic. Otherwise, they would be subroutines. There's a relationship between the codomain and the range. The codomain is a superset of the range. It's the set of elements that we were allowing to come to us, where the range is the elements that we will actually see. So codomain and domain describe our intention in defining the function. The range defines sort of its reality. All right, surjective. And this may be where we end. We may not get to invertible today, we'll see. What surjective means at least one element of the domain maps to each element of the codomain. Another way of saying this is say the codomain equals the range. I can reach every element of the codomain. Okay? And so this is called onto because we're saying there is some value that maps onto each element of the range. We think about these arrow settings, we can always get there somehow. And this is called surjective, again, sort of using the Latin version of how we would talk about that same idea. So, how would these concepts of injective and surjective look if we think of them as graphs? If it's injective, then I know that I'm never going to have two arrows pointing to the same thing, no matter how things work. So this would be injective. And if I were to draw it instead, where we have maybe two arrows pointing to the same value, that would not be injective because I'm not having only one thing mapping to any one thing. If I think about onto, it is onto if every element of the codomain is also an element of the range. And so if I have something mapping to each value, then I am onto, even if it's not total. Okay, I just need something to map to each element of the codomain. I'm not onto if there is some element of the codomain that nothing maps to. Okay, and that extra thing causes a problem. Why would I care about these things? There's various reasons this might matter. If we think about onto, sometimes I want to solve a problem in a program. Oh, sorry. Is a surjective function necessarily total? No. Surjective functions don't have to be total. They can be partial. Are all functions either injective or surjective? No, I can be neither. As a matter of fact, I drew here something that is neither, right? There is some element of the codomain that's not an element of the range and some element of the codomain that's in there twice. So these are distinct ideas. You don't have to be either one. Can you map a domain value to multiple codomain values under surjective? So functions, by definition, will create one value for any given argument. it might be a tuple, right? It might, or a sequence. It might be more than one internal element, but it's going to have exactly one there, so they aren't ambiguous. We will talk about relations on Wednesday, which generalize this to an idea that if we can't compute it, if there could be several possible answers. But for functions, there is always at most one element of the codomain that's mapped from the domain that allows us to compute the function. I don't know what f of x equals 3c means. Oh, if c is a constant, depends on what I define the codomain to be. If I define the codomain to be a singleton set containing only that constant, then it would be surjective, but not one-to-one. If I assume this larger set of the codomain of whatever set c was an element of, then that would be neither correct. The difference between a set of allowable y and the set of possible y. Again, we think about, I define a function like the squaring function. I might define the square of a natural number. I might find the square of a real number to be a real number, but in practice, it is only positive real numbers, right? And so that range is the things that can actually be realized. The codomain is this idea of the allowable things, the things I have defined my function to support. Which one is which in practice will depend somewhat on context. But very often in programming, we're going to use a data type to represent these sets. And so I'm going to say that I'm putting a double into my square function, and I'm getting a double out, but the double out doesn't cover all possible doubles. All right. We are out of time. So we will pick up with talking about a little bit about why we care about injective and surjective, as well as introducing the idea of bijection and how these are used in analyzing things, and run some examples in class on Wednesday. I will see you all on Wednesday.